Well, good evening and welcome to a very special episode of The Slow Chat. If you're watching on the Reignite Democracy Australia Victoria page, do not adjust your television sets. Nothing has gone wrong. Monica has not had gender reassignment surgery. My name is Topher Field and I have the pleasure of chatting with Monica tonight. I need to get out of the habit of calling them interviews because they're not, they're chats. And I've been hoping to have a slow chat with Monica for, well, basically, actually before she was out of prison, but then reached out to her, I don't know, in probably what would have been the maddest week of her life, the week she got out of prison. And she was understandably pretty busy. Can you believe people don't just drop everything and completely rearrange their lives to come on a live with me? I know, I'm so offended. However, she has made herself available tonight. I'm very much looking forward to this. We have a lot to chat about. Monica and I have met previously. We've had a couple of good conversations before, and I consider Monica, well, actually, in a way, I kind of owe Monica a debt of gratitude because I was recently arrested just on Wednesday of last week. But with me, they kind of did the Rex Hunt. They caught me, kissed me, and let me go again. It was just sort of a three-hour thing into the police station, signed some paperwork, and they never tried to impose crazy bail conditions on me. And I think there's two factors that went into that. One, I think I got lucky with the officers involved and the one who's doing, you know, sort of handling my case. I think I got lucky with that. But number two, I don't think they're going to try that again because Monica absolutely kicked their asses and made them regret their attempt to impose just absolutely ridiculous bail conditions on her. Other people have, previous to Monica, have been slapped with pretty harsh bail conditions and accepted them. And Monica, to my knowledge, I hope I'm not doing anyone a disservice, but to my knowledge, Monica was the first one that really just stood up and said, no, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to go all the way. So I reckon I got off light on Wednesday of last week, in large part thanks to this wonderful young lady we're going to speak to in just a moment. Now, for those not familiar with the format, this is my way of decompressing. If you don't know who I am, what I do, that's fine. Just trust me, I need a lot of decompressing. So I'm going to enjoy one of my favorite little vices here while I have a chat with Monica. And for those, just to save people asking, people always ask, I'm trying something new today, the Six Isles. It is a blend, but it's a blend from the Isles, which is my favorite region. So I'm hopeful. I've had a couple of sips. Yeah, it's not bad. I'm just not bad. So anyway, hopefully that's all the cigar questions out of the way. That's all of the whiskey questions out of the way. And now, finally, let me bring on the wonderful Monica Schmidt. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very, very well. Listen, we have not actually had a catch-up since you went into prison. We actually haven't spoken at all. So this is us basically having a catch-up live to air.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Let's just have a chat. And look, there is a lot to talk about because a lot has happened. If I can just give a brief summary, obviously, most people following this will know sort of some of what's happened to me. In your case, Monica, you were arrested. You were offered absurd bail conditions. You refused to accept them. You then went through this process, which I'll get you to cover because I don't really know sort of the process. You ended up being released 22 days later. You got engaged on the day of your release. Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks.
And then since then, RDA has announced, and you're going to have to tell me about this as well because I don't know the details, some kind of is it a partnership or some kind of a working relationship with the United Australia Party as well. So there is a lot that has gone on since we last had a catch up. So welcome. Thank you for coming on. Do you have a drink or something with you?
I do.
Excellent.
It is an espresso martini. It is.
I was going to say that does not look like a wine.
No, it's one thing. One good thing that's kind of come out of COVID is I've gotten really good at them. So when you said I had to bring a drink on, that was the first thing I thought of.
I applaud your taste. Actually, my wife and I had espresso martinis on entry at our wedding reception. Everyone was handed espresso martinis then. So I'm a big fan. Very good choice. All right, where do we even start? For those who may not know, because obviously there are people watching from my YouTube and from my Facebook as well, can you tell us a little bit about Monica Schmidt pre-COVID and why you decided to kind of go, I need to do something, I need to say something, and that in time turned, you know, we met, we talked about stuff, you made the decision to start Reignite Democracy Australia, and it eventually led up to your arrest, but there's a story before that as well. So how about we just start at the beginning? When COVID came along, why did you even get involved?
Okay, so about 3 years leading up to COVID, I had kind of gone on this, you know, self-development journey, some would say. It sounds cliche, but it's absolutely true. I was, you know, 29, single. I was engaged and got, you know, didn't work out. And I was like, okay, so I'm 29. I've done really well in real estate. what am I going to do? Just keep working and just living my life like this? And I was like, no, that doesn't sound like fun. So I decided to travel. I went to third world countries and I helped in orphanages and things like that. Then I picked up a camera and I started asking locals questions, tour guides, local hairdressers, children. I just started taking footage and I realized that I really liked it. I also realized it was good for my character building because I think I tend to talk too much. So it was really good to ask questions for once and listen to people. So then I traveled America in a minivan with a bed in the back. I just did that for a year and a half. I went to all the national parks and I was alone the whole time. So I really learned how to be alone with myself, which, by the way, came in handy in isolation in prison.
I can only imagine, yes.
So I had kind of fought my demons long before now, which is a process, but here we are. Anyway, so I came home in around October before COVID hit and I was – didn't know what I was going to do. I had a lot of editing work to do from all the footage I had taken. So I thought I might just make a documentary or write a blog or something like that. And I was I still hadn't decided to go back to work. The idea of going back into real estate after traveling alone for 3 years seemed very boring. So then I started doing some part-time real estate work, but not full-time. And I was still just like sussing it out. And then COVID happened. And like everyone else, I was unsure, but straight away I smell a rat because I'm just suspicious of any government authority, really. So I was just suspicious and I wasn't scared because I have a pretty strong immune system and I'm reasonably healthy. So I just thought, it'll be okay. Anyway, it was June, July, and August of 2020 when I just started thinking, geez, I want to do something, you know, and there's all these people with all this anger and aggression and you can't protest and you can't leave the house and you can't go to church and there's no outlet for your aggression. And I know that's not healthy for you. You can get alcohol and fast food, but you can't exercise or you can't see your friends, which is like a healthy version of addiction. And I just thought, well, I've got to come up with a way for people to get rid of these emotions. So I thought of a live stream protest. And I think I had you on my second show. So my first show,
I'm deeply wounded that it was your second show and not your first. I've never quite got over that.
I don't think we had met before then, but
probably not. Probably not. I'm just giving you a hard time.
No, it's fine. I had four people on the show and I had like 4,500 comments and I collated them into like subject headings and I made like pie graphs and bar graphs and I sent it to all the members of parliament. And that live stream had 1,500 live viewers and I've never had a live stream that big ever and no one knew who I was. So it just goes to show how much it was needed. But that was also back in the day when you could actually plan an event on Facebook and not get censored. So that was different as well. It just kind of snowballed from there. Topher, I barely knew the Prime Minister's name before COVID. I didn't care about politics. My only skill was in sales, which obviously makes me a decent networker. But otherwise, I had no idea about any of this stuff. It was just like, I guess the 3 years of self-development probably led me to be able to handle what was to come.
Can I pause you? Because I think I asked you this when we first met, but I don't remember the answer. Why did you actually reach out to me? What was it of mine that you even saw in the first place?
I don't know if I can remember exactly what it was. Were you outspoken about COVID?
Sure. I did my first video in March. That was when the data came out from Nut Witkowski and from Professor John Ioannidis, and I began to get outspoken then because it was already pretty clear to me what was going on.
I know. You did. You did a video about the science or something along those lines. And then I found out later that obviously you'd be an activist for 12 years fighting, different things. And I had no idea that you lived in the same town as me or the other connections either.
So we caught up for coffee and I think I said to you at the time, and I don't think I'm going to upset you by saying this because I think you know that this was the case. You were pretty green. You were full of energy. You were full of beans. Pretty green, but you were hungry to know more, and so you asked questions, and I answered them to the best of my ability with what little I know. And then you kind of went away, and you threw your energy into this, and all of a sudden, I'm just kind of watching, and then I'm like, oh, Monica's just posted up this thing because we friended each other on Facebook, and then I'm like, oh, what's this thing, Reignite Democracy Australia? And then watching it, it seemed like it just took off. Like, literally within the first few weeks, it just absolutely took off.
Yeah, actually, now you're reminding me, you know, there's so much has happened. I forgot that you were kind of like a mentor to me for the first couple of months because I was getting trolled and, you know, all that terrible stuff. And you said something to me that I have repeated many, many times, which is that, Monica, you don't have to reply to everyone and you don't have to say yes to everyone and you don't have to do everything people want you to. And that has actually helped me a lot. And I haven't actually thanked you for that piece of advice. So thank you.
Oh, you're more than welcome. There's this funny thing that's happened with yourself, with Carly, who I've done a slow chat with. She was one of the people that A Current Affair came for and then the online mob came for. I find myself in a position where I'm kind of an unofficial, I think mentor is giving myself too much credit, but I'm a resource. I'm someone that people kind of bounce questions off for a lot of people that find themselves in these sorts of situations. And I've got to say, it's really gratifying for me. I never really wanted to be big in this world. In my head, I would have been long gone from this a long time ago. And actually, if you go back far enough on my Facebook page, I think about 5 years, you'll find that I actually spent an entire year not posting. Mm-hmm. I didn't post for an entire year because I was quite happy to let Topher die. Like I would just let it disappear as a part of my life. This has never been an ambition for me. And I kind of, there was a phase about two and a half years ago where I kind of resented the fact that I was even still doing it. By the way, Nicola, these are being made into a podcast. If you just search for Slow Chat with Topher Field, you'll find my back catalogue of podcasts on whatever platform you prefer. But it's actually the most satisfying thing for me through all of this has been being able to be there. It's just a little bit of a 12-year veteran of you know, I've seen a little bit of the nonsense. I know how some of these games are played. I certainly don't know everything. And so thank you. I genuinely appreciate that coming from you, Monica. I do. So at what point did you start to become aware that you might be targeted for arrest or you know, had you been visited by the cops a couple of times before that finally happened?
Well, actually, I lived in a unique living situation and that every time they came for me, I was never there. So I think that really annoyed them, to be honest.
That's probably why they targeted you on the road.
They've still never found me in a house. So that's not really, I didn't go out of my way to be sneaky. It just worked out that way. So, that's probably why. But, yes, I got the letters and the threats and, you know, I lived with other family members and they had to deal with it basically. You know, I lived with children and babies and things like that. So it was pretty distressing.
Yeah. So in terms of the letters and that sort of stuff, what was it in relation to? What were you doing that they wanted to chase you for?
Well, they went through this period of time, and you would know this, where you got a letter too. It's like they pre-warn you not to go to an event.
Yeah, correct.
And I think it's just to solidify that if they were to arrest you, they have like an extra something. But, you know, I was always a journalist, so I just ignored them because it didn't apply to me in my eyes. And I never organized one of the big events. I organized a few small events that were when we had the window of, you know, perceived freedom. There was no arrests or any violence or pepper spray or anything, any of those smaller events. So,
I don't know. Okay. So I mean, you go into the same categories, people like Zoe Buller, who simply posted about a Facebook event that was perfectly legal. We were under stage 3 restrictions at the time. It was perfectly legal for her to do that. She encouraged people to follow the CHOS orders. She still ended up getting arrested in her own home. The militarization of the police, not just in their tactics on the ground, but also in what they're doing behind the scenes, has been one of the more extraordinary things that I'd love to say I never expected to see in Australia. I didn't expect to see in Australia until the 2030s. I thought we were another 10 years away.
Well, I think they made a mistake not waiting 10 more years, because imagine 10 more years of you know, education, brainwashing, university, et cetera. I think they did it too early because people like us and people like the Australians who are standing up, I think we're going to win. And that's because I think they got a little bit overzealous. And the older people involved wanted to see the, you know, their work unfold.
they overplayed their hand, I think. Now, we could have a big conversation about whether this is a grand plan or whether this is opportunism or what all of that is. But look, these are conversations I can have with lots of different people. There are some conversations that really only you understand because of what you've done and what you've kind of been through. So I'd love to kind of stay on that. Talk me through, if it's not too difficult, talk me through the arrest in as much or as little detail as you want to. And then You then entered this parallel universe, which I only got a very slight taste of. Like I was 3 hours with the nicest cops you could possibly imagine. The people that came for me, you can see it on, like, I live streamed the actual when they came to the door. They went to great pains to be so nice to me. And that continued throughout the entire experience. I never had a negative interaction at a personal level. I never had a negative interaction at all with a single person throughout that whole process. They were, as I like to call them, the nicest human rights violators I've ever met. Your experience was a little bit different to that. But you enter this parallel world where they try and make you feel isolated and cut off. And there's various psychological techniques they use to try and make sure that you feel intimidated and powerless, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that journey and what led to the decision not to accept the bail conditions that you were offered.
Sure. Well, I'll start 3 days beforehand, actually, because I feel like I was being, you know, I'm a believer in God. Most people know that. It's beside the point, but something prepared me for it. So 3 days beforehand, I had a lucid dream, you know, before bed, before going to sleep. It was very vivid, but I was awake. And the dream was exactly this. I was going to get arrested for incitement, even if they didn't have good enough charges or evidence. They'd just do it anyway to give me really harsh bail conditions to silence me, and I would not sign them and I would go to prison. That's exactly what I had a dream. So I even had that conversation with Morgan the next day. It was such an intense, vivid dream that I had to have that discussion with Morgan. And I said to him, and this was now, I think it was the Saturday night, so 3 days beforehand, I said to Morgan, look, if that happens to me, I'm not going to sign them and I'm going to go to prison. And like, I hope you're going to be okay with that. And he said, why would you do that? You know? And I'm like, well, if it's going to make a difference, I'll do it. I don't have any children. I don't have a job that needs me there and stuff. So I thought, I'm the person that can do this. Many other people would have wanted to, but they weren't in the position to because of their family and their children and their wife, you know?
Yeah.
So I was psychologically actually prepared for it, which is weird. And to be honest, I'm surprised it took that long because, you know, they don't really need that much evidence to discharge you because then they get a year and a half to 2 years to wait for the trial anyway. So even if the evidence is terrible, they can still silence you if you sign bail conditions. So I was surprised it took this long. But I think with RDA getting especially more effective with the community group networks that we have around Australia, I think that becomes a real threat because when people band together, they're less controllable. But anyway, so I went to an interview and I was being followed from that interview, and just around the corner I got arrested. So there was like three undercover cop cars and there was like, I don't know, maybe eight police there. And, you know, they were nice to me the whole time, Topher, I got to say. Some of them were not like welcoming to me, but actually a lot of them were nice. And any chance I got, I just finished having an interview with Dr. Ian Brighthope about vitamin D and C and zinc how it could have an effect on the pandemic. And so I was actually using the opportunity to school every single police officer about going to the doctor and getting a vitamin D test because it was all fresh in my mind, you know?
Yeah.
So I distracted myself by chatting to the cops and trying to humanize them. And also it makes me not angry because if I sat there all silent and stuff, I would start thinking in my head and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So I was just weirdly tearful, if that makes sense. So we went to the Dandenong Remand Center and there was a moment where I thought, oh, maybe I'll get out, you know, because my lawyer said, oh, they've got nothing on you. It's no big deal. It was a very short moment that happened. Everything in prison and everything with the police system, what I realized, everything takes a really long time. And I think that's part of the tactic, but I was literally waiting around in a, you know, in an interview room for 12 hours.
Can I just pause you for a second here? Yeah. John, you're the second person to say this. No. Okay. This is how I decompress. No. If you don't like it, go to something else.
Whose show is it anyway? Anyway. Yes. So I got interviewed and I said no comment to everything with, by the way, I was brought up to respect authority and I felt really uncomfortable saying no comment. I kept saying, sorry, 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 no comment, no comment. That's what I had to do, right? You might have done the same thing. 100%, anyway, 100%. So then we had this strange like bail hearing at at 12:30 a.m., basically the police weren't willing to make a judgment call on, they didn't want to be the ones to sign off on keeping me overnight, right?
Yeah.
So they needed to get someone in to do that for them. And I was a bit naive in thinking I could like argue my way into getting bail. But yeah, the person who was there had already decided they weren't going to. It was the one negative thing about having a higher profile is they weren't willing to take the risk of being the one to put me back on the street and cause all those apparent problems. So, yeah. So it was 1 o'clock and I found out I was sleeping overnight and there was that. So, you know, the whole strip search thing and, you know, signing on the dotted line that says prisoner next to it, that was really confronting for me. And then that night I was, it was cold. They took my Kathmandu jacket off me for some reason. So I was pretty cold, but it was okay. Like,
can I just, you know. Dear, we've met and we've chatted before. Can you cut that out? That's absolutely unnecessary. Do that again and I will ban you. Carry on.
That's all right. So I went into, you know, the cell and there was another lady in the prison, not in the same cell, but in another prison that was squealing and carrying on really bad. She was having a hard time. And I felt like at that moment, and doesn't matter whether anyone believes in devils or whatever, but it felt like it was kind of like the devil talking to me and saying, you can't do this. You can't do this. Just, just give it up, you know, stop trying to be a hero or, you know, you can't do this. Anyway, so the next day happened. My lawyers told me that the bail conditions were the worst they've ever seen. They said that they've seen easier bail conditions on people who have run through houses with children with a machete. So the original bail conditions I was told, which didn't make it to even the first hearing, they wanted to shut down my bank accounts and like all sorts. So it was pretty crazy.
So to my understanding, they wanted to shut down RDA, which had an application to become a political party. Is that detail correct at the time?
Yeah, it is.
So they were literally trying to use bail conditions to control political parties and political outcomes in this country.
Yeah, well, I'll go into that. So when the actual hearing happened, it was about 1 o'clock the next day. And yeah, I mean, when she read the first bail condition, which was that Monica Schmidt would have her own curfew from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. every day up until the trial. So that's regardless of the show directions, regardless of vaccination. Monica would not be able to go for a walk past 7 o'clock for a year and a half to 2 years. That enough was for I was not going to sign. But what made it worse is obviously the precedent that would have been set if I had signed those bail conditions would have been really scary because the wording was really interesting. It said to delete all past posts or delete any communication that incites opposition to the CHO directions. There's a big difference between inciting someone to break the law or inciting someone to oppose the law. So basically they were putting a bail condition on me to not have an opinion. And being at the time the vice president of a political party, if I wasn't being vocal against the current government, I literally wouldn't be doing my job. So it was taking all my livelihood away, plus I had 7 staff at the time. Plus I had about 90 community groups. They wanted me to delete all of it, all of it. Anything that I was in control of or in part control of, which is impossible to control, they wanted me to delete all of it. So it was just like, and then there was other crazy ones too, but those are the worst. I just thought I really actually thought about my staff a lot and also the community groups. We've worked so hard to build up these groups and they're providing mental support for people. Like, who knows? They might have saved a life. I don't know.
Correct.
And I was like, I'm not taking that away from these people. So.
Yeah. Look, it was absurd and I've heard different things and it's nice to hear things directly out of your mouth. Like I said at the start, we haven't caught up since all this happened. Right. So it's nice to kind of get because there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of people who have a lot to say that don't actually know what they're talking about. So you made the decision you weren't signing those bail conditions. This was so you'd spent one night in prison at that point at the Dandenong Remand or somewhere else?
Dandenong Remand.
Right. And then having had that experience, you still had the spine to say, I'm not signing even though I know that that's going to hold me in here for even longer. Did you have any inkling of how long that would be? Because you'd be awaiting a bail hearing in front of a judge, presumably, or a rehearing. Did you know at the time how long that was likely to be?
Well, actually, I had already considered that it would be all the way until November 10th.
Yeah, so all the way until the trial.
That's what my lawyer said to me. He said, you know, you could be there till the November 10th. And I said, okay. So I was prepared to do that, to be honest. So at 22 days actually was just enough time to have a break and not too much time to be psychologically damaged. So it was it was a good number.
I'm very glad to hear it. Now, you were in isolation because I'm assuming here you chose not to take a COVID test, and so therefore they just could have sort of shoved you away in a corner somewhere. Was that almost a relief for you? Were you happy not to be in GPOP?
So at the beginning I was. It was interesting. It was supposed to be 14 days and then I was going to be let out. But while I was in there on like the fifth or sixth day, the policy changed and it turned to 19 days, which is interesting. So I thought the last 3 days, I thought I might be able to go out, and I had been speaking to other prisoners because you can speak to them through the door. You can't see anyone's faces. But so I'd been speaking and getting a bit of a date, like a bit of information on how to conduct myself. And I'd been mentally preparing for that, speaking to the staff and stuff. And to be honest, part of me kind of wanted to experience it now that I was so close, because not many law-abiding, tax-paying citizens get to have this story. Imagine a dinner table. Like, what's the craziest thing that's happened to you? I went to prison for 22 days. Like, I mean, you can't really get any better than that, right? And I love a good story. So, I kind of wanted to go out there, but it's weird. After the 19 days, they still just they moved me from COVID isolation to just isolation. And then the other girls in there were actually girls who had been kicked out of the open prison because they were too dangerous. So
too violent.
But I got 1 hour, I got half an hour on a treadmill for the first time. So, you know, just so everyone knows, I didn't go outside once. There was no sunshine. There was no outdoor activity. I actually got banned from the phones because I was trying to run RDA from within the prison, which you're not allowed to do.
I'm reasonably sure that exceeds the limits set out in certain war crimes articles. And of course, people will say, "Oh, yes, but you're not a war criminal. It's a different set of rules." Okay, it's a different set of rules. But I'm pretty sure that anything beyond, I believe it's 14 days in isolation, if you do that to a prisoner of war, is considered to be torture.
Look, I don't know. I haven't even looked into that sort of thing. Like I said, it didn't feel torturous at the time, obviously, but but you know, for someone who hasn't maybe dealt with the demons as well as I had already done in my past, I think that would have been really hard. I was really blessed to have the ability to get through it, you know. Excuse me.
If I can say, I'm tremendously glad that you did. Because I was watching as best as I could whilst I was busy with everything else, what was happening with you, and trying to think through when they come for me, because, you know, they've arrested a lot of other people. There's, you know, there's, when they arrest someone with the profile of a Monica Schmidt, obviously lots of people hear about it, but there's plenty of other people being arrested who didn't have that profile. And so these arrests are ongoing, and I knew that my time would come. Eventually my name would rise to the top of the list and they'd be at my door. And by watching you and by watching other people, I was able to put in place an action plan. Thankfully, I didn't need most of it because I was out in 3 hours. And again, I think that's partly because they got burned by you. But we had a full action plan in place. There's videos that were due to be released at certain times if I ended up having to stay in prison for the same reason that you did. There were a number of things, certain international journalists that I've got friendships with as a result of my 12 years of work, et cetera. There was a part of me that was almost hoping, because they would have stepped on such a hand grenade, it would have just absolutely blown up. As it was, I was released in 3 hours and it still went around the world and was being reported on in the US and in a few other places as well. So I was able to watch and learn from what happened to you. So thank you for being my tutorial.
Well, sorry for ruining it for you. I mean, you know.
No, that's right. You stole my fun, Monica. How dare you? All right. So then the day comes when you're released and you have the coolest engagement story of anyone that I know. You managed to outdo my engagement story with my wife. So thanks again, Monica. You're just ruining everything.
Sorry.
And then you emerge to discover kind of what's happened, and a lot had happened in the time that you were in, and a lot had happened in the world of RDA. A lot had happened. There was the fundraiser that happened. Was that you? Was that RDA set that up, or was that somebody else set that up? What happened with that?
Well, obviously, I had no idea about it because I was in prison and I had no phone privileges. So I don't know. There was quite a few people helping manage RDA when I was gone. So I actually think some of my family members and my staff members actually had a harder time than I did. I was kind of protected there. No one expected anything from me. I just slept and did what I wanted, you know. So anyway, I didn't know about it, but I was very shocked to hear about it. And, you know, we've raised obviously more than we need for my finances. So what I've done is I've emailed the whole database of donators, and I've asked them if they would mind if I repurpose that money for only legal battles that I think are good setting precedences. So we've got about three different cases that we're going to support, and we're going to communicate with that. And obviously, if people wanted a refund, they were able to get a refund. So we've done all that properly, and they'll be happy to hear when we tell them the sorts of cases that we can support with the money that they've given. So we're being really careful to make sure it's separate, of course, and respect what they wanted. But
And this is a thing that I've noticed, and I want to hark back to the episode I did a little while ago with Carly. She, a current affair came for her, tried to destroy her life. Before that, she released an Instagram video. She was a small business owner, had no real profile. She poured her heart out on an Instagram video, and it went viral and got viewed 40 million times. And someone started a GoFundMe on her behalf.
Oh, no.
It flew up to about $65,000 or $60,000, whatever it was, and she was literally asking the guy to shut it down. And he, I think, sincerely wanted to do the right thing, was like, no, we're going to raise as much as we can for you. And it became a massive problem for her. And in the end, she handed all the money back. She had already paid a bill with some of the money, so she handed everything back bar that money and basically said, fuck off, get lost with your problems. Like, I don't want this in my life. So sometimes well-meaning people can do things like that, and actually it actually becomes a massive problem and a massive headache. There's a lot of people, I hope you know, Mami, saying you became a controversial figure as a result of the arrest. And a lot of people's gripe with you is actually the fundraiser. And one of the things that I wanted to make sure people understood from this interview was that was actually out of your hands. And so I'm glad that we've covered that, because I think it's just such an, financial integrity is an incredibly important thing. And you're right to judge people who do the wrong thing with other people's money. That's completely acceptable. But you should listen to the person that you're criticizing before you criticize them. Understand what happened.
And can I say that on that note, is unfortunately, because people are experiencing so much pain and they're so desperate for results, that there are scams out there. I absolutely do not blame them for thinking however they think. But then you've got to look at the actions from the organization or the person before you judge. And we had a court case for Pete Allen from South Australia who got fired from the mining. And it was my first fundraiser that I got involved with. And we raised $25,000 in 3 days. He actually pulled out of the court case and I refunded all the money. So I think I've built that sort of trust with the people that know me. But obviously from the outside, it's like, this girl goes to prison and then they fundraise $300,000. Like, this girl's getting rich in prison. But like, obviously, if anyone understands my character, like, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I did anything disrespectful to the people that support me. I'd rather just go back to prison and,
And the same thing's happened with me with the, so I launched the fundraiser for the documentary Battleground Melbourne, which you can find on my Facebook page or in my bio on Instagram. And that was going okay. I'd raised about one third of the minimum budget that I needed to make that a viable documentary project, until I got arrested. And within about 48 hours of me being arrested, we'd raised the entire minimum budget. So that minimum budget had been met. And so I'm actually going to give Victoria Police a credit. At the end of the film, I'm actually going to say thank you to Victoria Police for helping to raise the funds for this particular documentary. I mean, it really, the timing could not have been more perfect. But there is this weird psychological thing that goes on. I'll give you a few anecdotes from myself before I throw it back to you for your thoughts on this. People are looking for a villain. And so often they try and find the villain in the person who is very close to agreeing with them, but not quite. And so there's this idea of controlled opposition. Oh, this person is controlled opposition. I get that said about me on a regular basis. And what controlled opposition is someone that you almost agree with, but not quite, right? Oh, no, they're wrong on that thing. They're controlled opposition because they're trying to lead people astray on this. I had another incident on the Wednesday when I was at the Shrine. And yes, I'm quite happy to admit I was at the protests. I had this young tradie, because the tradies had suddenly taken over the whole protest movement. It had all gone a bit sideways, in my opinion, if you watch my live streams from the time and my slow chats from the time, I explain all of that. And I had this young guy who decided that I must be a cop. I'm not quite sure how he decided that. And so he starts trying to point me out and call me out as a cop and trying to attract attention to me because I was this infiltrator. And then someone else had to calm him down and go, no, mate, this is Topher. I recognize him. He's all right. Like, there's this, a lot of people are psychologically geared up and on edge and looking for an enemy. They're looking for someone to kind of, I guess, target that energy at, a little bit like what you were saying very early on. People have got all this pent up energy and they've got nowhere to, to kind of put it, and they end up targeting the wrong people. So from there, you came out of prison, you had to readjust to the world as it had become and make decisions about the way forward. What's the way forward for Monica Schmidt walking out of prison after 22 days? What was your decision?
So the first thing I was really excited to see is how well my staff had done without me. And it made me realize that if I could get the like every day-to-day workings of RDA kind of going without me, because I used to have my hands in everything, Topher. I used to do all the posting, everything.
Yep.
I was working 12 to 14 hour days. I was not really happy with that at the time. And I was going backwards with my health and things like that. So I needed that circuit breaker, but so when I came out, I was like, you know what? I don't have to do everything all the time straight away. I can just hold on and breathe a little bit more.
You've clearly got good people around you, given what happened while you were in.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was some messy things, definitely. But what I really want to focus on now, Topher, is I'm kind of done trying to inform people now, because I feel like the information is out there.
Yep.
Like, I'm happy to share current news and write new articles of new content. Well, not me, but other people. But I'm kind of done trying to wake people up, okay? Because if they're not awake now, they're probably not open to it. And secondly, the information is there. Like, it's all over the place, right? So for me, the way forward is legally and through Parliament. And what I'm going to do as a contributor is I'm going to get out as much content as I can. So now, you know, I want to get a professional studio, and I just want to do interview after interview, and I want to connect with everyday Australians that aren't even in politics or about COVID. Maybe we can talk about something completely unrelated to COVID. You know, I want to diversify a little bit more in that way and let RDA kind of run itself. And do you want me to go into the UAP stuff now, or did you want to phrase that?
Yeah, sure. Look, because there's a lot to talk about with politics. I would love to hear, because my instinctive reaction is that this is a good thing. But I'd love for you to talk me through the thought process, how it came about. And then I'd love to chat with you about the implications and why I think it's actually a good thing.
Okay, sure. So the political, again, the legal side of things is, just so everyone knows, RDA has hired in-house legal counsel now. So he's going to be giving legal advice on the website and things like that. And he'll check over things that I write to make sure that they're good as well. Because as you know,
bail conditions.
I've been pretty green and I've made all the mistakes, and it's been fun and rocky and hard for other people to watch, but you know, I'm getting better. So that's good. But anyway, so that's the legal side of things. And of course, the things that we're supporting, but the parliamentary side of things is.
Sorry. The parliamentary side of things. Hold that thought. Michelle, absolutely. The trolls are bad. And what I've noticed is the trolls get really aggressive when I'm talking to a female. I honestly, this is something that I'm really beginning to notice now. Carly, yourself, others, when I'm talking to a female, there seems to be a pile on from the trolls, much more aggressive than when I'm talking to another male. So shame on you for doing that. If you're watching this and you've come here for the purpose of that, absolute shame on you. And if you are actually listening to what's being talked about, you would know that most of the reasons why you hate this woman on my screen right now are actually incorrect in the first place. So Marcus, who's helping me with the ban hammer tonight, feel free to ban away. Normally I let trolls go because they feed the algorithm. But I'm sick of the sexism, and I'm sick of watching the trolls tonight have definitely been worse than what they normally are. So Marcus, ban away. Get happy with the ban hammer, mate. Sorry, Monica, the politics.
I do tend to attract the trolls, but anyway, that's fine. Morgan has a big profile and he says the same thing. He gets so disappointed. He's like, why do you get so much hate and I don't, you know? So there must be a female thing. Anyway.
I think it is.
Politics. So about 4 months ago, I, with the committee, helped to start RDA Party. Now, I never wanted to get involved in politics in that way. All I wanted RDA to be was a really robust lobbying group that would support a member of parliament from any party, okay?
Yep.
LDP, yep. IMOP, Liberal, probably not Labor, Greens, or, you know, those ones. But
you got to have some standards.
Yeah. I mean, I would still hero them if they did something good, but I would never help campaign for them. But anyway, so I started RDA Party and I got to start with the committee. I've got to be honest, it was an uphill battle the whole time. It was hard. It was really hard. I already had a full plate and then I was doing all of that. And, you know, we had one committee member leave. And so it was really rocky. And sometimes that means that it's not the right thing. Sometimes it means that you need to keep being persistent. Sometimes it's difficult to know the difference. I kept persisting. But it was when I went to prison for 3 weeks and it completely fell apart. So no one dealt with the admin. No one used the fact that I was a political prisoner as a way to get more members because the legislation had just changed that we now needed 1,500 members and we only had about 1,100. Like the fact that they missed out on that promoting opportunity, I came out and I was like, this is just like, this is not fun anymore. So not that it's about fun, but the only reason I wanted to start the political party was at the time, 4 months beforehand, there was no single party that I could fully align with. Okay. So I had tried, I had reached out to all of them more or less, and there was just something not quite right. So I was like, I'm going to have to try and start one myself. So we did. It seemed like it was the right thing to do at the time, and I don't regret it because I learned a lot. However, when UAP started, I was obviously trying to get Craig onto RDA Party, okay, but I just didn't have as much to offer, right? I tried. Me and Craig are really close. I see him as a mentor. When I was in prison, I saw TV ads coming on of UAP. As soon as Craig Kelly joined UAP, I told the committee, I'm feeling like I'm missing out on that. I want to be in on that. So I came out of prison, nothing had happened. And I was like, guys, I want to get rid of RDA Party and join UAP. That's what I want to do. That's what Morgan wanted to do as well. And he's running as a federal candidate. We didn't dissolve RDA Party. We joined with UAP. But in saying that, I now no longer have a stake in any party. So I just want to clarify for anyone watching, there is no contract. There is no exchange of money. There is absolutely nothing except for the fact that I think that they have the best chance of getting part of our country back, at least part of it. I can support them, but I can also support LDP, IMOP, GAP. I can, as a lobby group, I'm now free to support whoever I want. When there was RDA Party, I felt very boxed in that because RDA Party, RDA, right?
That had to be your first loyalty.
I'm actually a free agent. I don't owe them anything. They don't owe me anything. We just all want freedom. So
one of the things that I think is really important, so full disclosure, my first loyalty is Liberal Democrats, has been for about the last 8 years since I got involved with them. But there's a really important message that all of us, United Australia Party, Liberal Democrats, One Nation, IMOP, I'm sure there's others that I'm forgetting about. Anyone that is in any way freedom friendly, even though we might differ enormously in other areas of policy, anyone that is freedom friendly right now, we need to be encouraging everyone that votes for us to then vote preferentially for every other one of us before they put any of the majors on. I mean, if you absolutely have to finish with a major party just to make sure your vote isn't lost, sure. But the minute you put that major party anywhere in the list, that's where your vote is going to stop. It's not going to go through to any of the further parties down that list. So you need to put in the case of Monica, if you want to support Morgan, you need to put United Australia Party, then put the Liberal Democrats, then IMOP, and then One Nation. And then I'm sure there's others, and I will compile a formal list between now and the federal election for those that are interested in my thoughts on this. But the number one thing is not who you put at the number one spot. It's that you put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 without any majors being in that list. And that is our best chance. If everyone who's voting for a minor party does that, then someone from within those minor parties has a really good chance of nabbing a Senate seat off the Greens here in Victoria in the federal election. If this is a moment where the zeitgeist is changing and a lot of people are going to turn away from the major parties, we might see, two senators from Victoria that are not from the Liberals, Labor, Nationals or Greens. And to me, that would be an absolutely brilliant outcome.
I think more, Topher. I'm naively positive that's a gift but also a downfall. But I will say that UAP and RDA will be putting a lot of effort into education around voting because let's be honest, no one knew before, no one cared until the day, and then we did some Google searching or we asked our parents and that's how we voted. That can't happen anymore. And your vote can mean four votes if you're preferencing properly.
Correct.
I think this is going to be monumental, and UAP call Victoria the victorious Victoria because they think that Victoria is where we're going to win any sort of freedom. I will say as well that any of those smaller parties, no matter what's been said in between each other or online or any of them would be better than one of them.
Correct.
It just doesn't matter who you support. as long as you support one of the smaller people. And and also that they are working together behind the scenes. A lot of people think that, oh, if we could all just work together, everything would be so great. Actually, people are working together. It's just not potential, not public knowledge, but
It's not public. I mean, look, we know the major parties work with each other behind the scenes. The minor parties are working with each other behind the scenes. It's in the minor parties' best interest to get this message out about preferential voting, about making sure that you put all the minor parties before any of the major parties. There is a collective self-interest in that, but there's still a messaging problem because most of the minor parties don't have budget and they don't have a way to get that message out. And so this is why if you're a follower of mine, that's not the first time you've heard me talk about preferential voting, and I promise you it will not be the last, not even close, because this is a message that we've just got to hammer over and over again. Vote for every single minor party before you vote for any of the major parties. Look, I've been involved in politics for 12 years, and I've heard other people get excited about, oh, this is the moment when it's all going to change. I've watched minor parties come and go and burn out for a bunch of different reasons. If ever there was a moment that there was going to be a monumental change, this in my lifetime is the best opportunity for that to happen. So I don't know that I share your optimism beyond two senators in Victoria. It would be nice. I would love to be proven wrong. I would love to get you back on after the federal election sometime in the first half of next year and for you to be able to laugh at me and say, see, I told you so. That would be brilliant. Turning our attention to Victorian politics for a moment here, what are your thoughts on this act by Daniel Andrews to exclude from Parliament our elected members who won't prove their medical status? What does that say to you?
Well, it's Victoria leading the way again in the most draconian measures. You know, we're famous for all the wrong reasons. It's really interesting because didn't they exclude MPs from the mandatory? Brett Sutton said the MPs were actually exempt from the mandatory.
Yes, so they've done it as an internal procedural thing within Parliament.
It's really disappointing. When I found it, we just released an article about it today. The usual suspects voted for it, of course, but there was a bit of a surprise in there for me, Topher, which was the Justice Party, Tanya Maxwell and Stuart Grimley. They have actually voted for freedom at every opportunity. I've met Tanya Maxwell. I really, really like her. I thought that they wouldn't do that, so I'm a bit disappointed.
In the end, when it came to the, I always get the houses mixed up. Legislative Council is the upper house in Victoria, or Legislative Assembly? I get the two mixed up all the time.
I just call them upper and lower, Topher.
Yeah. So in the upper house, when it came to a vote, my understanding is there were only four that opposed it, and they were Tim Quilty and David Limbrick, who are two of my absolute favourite politicians right now in Victoria. But also Catherine Cumming, who's been doing some sensational work recently. She has really come into her own in the last, I would say, 6 months. And also Shooters, Fishers and Farmers, Jeff Borman.
Rod Barton.
It was Jeff Borman in the upper house. And I have to say, I've met him before. Lovely guy, ex-police officer. And I think that his instincts early on were incorrect, probably because of his background in the police force. And he voted for some stuff that I personally don't believe he should have, but that's my opinion. And he's obviously got a different one. But on this issue, he did at least come to the right side of this issue and say, no, this is not an appropriate thing for a parliament to be doing. I've been criticised for saying, hey, this is an attack on democracy. This is an incredibly dangerous thing to allow a government to do. And people keep saying to me, no, there's another election coming up in 2022. You can't say that democracy is under attack. We're still having elections. Well, listen, Russia has elections. Venezuela has elections, right? Don't talk to me about the election that we've got coming up. Talk to me about the fact that we're not actually honouring the results of the election we already had. That's, you know, an election for an election to mean something. Not only do we get to have the election, but the results have to be honoured. And we've already crossed the threshold where the results of our elections are no longer being honoured in this state.
And other votes even, I mean, this is a hard discussion to make, but the coercion and the manipulation within the media is so biased that, you know, it's so hard for anyone else to even have a go. And sometimes people, they form an opinion and they don't even know where that opinion formed, but they will back it up because somehow they formed it and who knows where it came from. So we have a really tough battle to beat censorship, to get votes in the right direction as well.
Yeah. Look, there's a massive messaging campaign needed going forward between now and the federal election, and then again between that federal election and the state election. One of the things I'm really hoping the federal election kicks the major parties in the butt, because the panic that will set in for the Labor Party with a state election potentially only 6 or 7 months away from when that federal election happens, the panic that will set in is going to be brilliant to watch. I'm going to be here permanently with a bag of popcorn, just enjoying watching that happen. Do you think it's possible for Daniel Andrews to not make it to the next Victorian election? Do you think that there's a way that he might not be the leader of the Labor Party by then?
Well, geez, if I was the leader of the Labor Party, I'd definitely get rid of him before the next election.
Sure, but he's the leader right now.
It's true, true. But, I mean, internally, as a smart party move, I would find a reason to convince him to leave so someone else can run in his place. But the thing is he's a narcissist. He is a textbook dictator. And so people like that don't take consideration, they don't take negotiation, and they don't look at what's better for everyone. Okay. They look at what's better for themselves. And he is so arrogant that I think he lives in a glass house and he actually doesn't realize how much people hate him. So he's probably going to want to go to the next election because he actually thinks that he's still loved, because his comments would be monitored by his staff. He wouldn't see anything. Remember that day he was like, "Oh, what are people even protesting?"
Yeah.
And they were
I had literally the day before that was the protest. I gave my speech in which I laid it out in the simplest terms. It was the shortest and simplest speech of any of the speeches I did at any of the protests. Clearly articulating why that crowd of anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 people had gathered in the city that day. And then he has the gall to stand up and say, "Oh, I don't even know why people are protesting." Like, the guy's either an idiot or he thinks he can get away with that sort of stuff. And I don't know which one's worse.
I just think he's really arrogant. I don't know. Like, you can convince, when you lie to yourself for so long, you can convince yourself of almost anything. So he might even think that he's trying to protect our health. He might.
That's a very real possibility. I am worried that he's actually got such a superhero complex that he genuinely believes that he's saving the world right now and that we're just ungrateful and we don't understand.
It could be. But he could. I definitely wouldn't put it past him to be evil enough to know the truth and just push it anyway. So there's really no way of knowing. But I like to imagine that maybe I'm wrong. Sometimes I'm like, "Oh, maybe I've got it wrong. Maybe it is really dangerous and maybe the medical procedure is really healthy and, you know." And then, like, I look at it and I'm just like, "Well, no."
I can't con myself.
I try, and then I just realize that, hang on, the bottle shops were open, the brothels were open, but the parks were closed. And I'm like,
The playgrounds were closed. Yeah. Well, that proved to be a real turning point. That playground thing, I think, was the beginning of the turn of the worm when it came to his popularity. He lost, I believe it was 12 percentage points of popularity, down from 56% to 44% support for his lockdowns in the 2 weeks that the playgrounds were closed. And when I watched that worm turn, I made a prediction that, was it October? Was it August, September was going to be the peak of the lockdowns. And that but that wouldn't be the peak of the mandates. So the lockdowns would peak and would begin to come away because he'd be chasing the popularity, right? He'd be watching the polls and he'd be chasing it with reduced lockdowns, but that he would be using the mandates as his cover to be able to say, "Oh, no, it's because everyone's been vaccinated that I can now ease the restrictions. And so, therefore, you know, it was me all along. I did this. I saved you all." That's the narrative that he wants to be able to, to promote. At some point, he's going to be gone. Before the election, at the election, heaven forbid he wins again, who knows? Anyway, but at some point, as a state, we're going to have to find a way to move on. And there has been an enormous amount of division created in the last 18 months. There's a lot of division being created right now. We have the vaccinated being pitched against the unvaccinated. We have the pro-lockdown people being pitched against the anti-lockdown people. We have the people who get their information from the television being pitched against the people who actually, you know, bother to go and look at things for themselves. There's an enormous amount of division. How do we come back from this? How do we rebuild something that resembles the Victoria and the city of Melbourne that we loved before all this came along?
I think we will be fine. I think humanity is incredibly adaptable. Like, for example, when I was in prison, I adapted. It was strange. It was weird. I felt safe there, actually, when I came out. I felt uncomfortable for a moment. But the point is like, as soon as the narrative is broken and there is real life back. People will start visiting their family again. They'll start working like normal. They'll start having their goals and aspirations and follow their football teams. And this will be a bleep in history. And I believe in humanity. I believe in police, in nurses, in doctors. I'm not going to judge any of them for doing the, like, taking bad orders. I'll judge the people who made the orders. And I think that's fair for everyone to say that. So I think we'll be fine. Humanity's amazing. I have faith that we'll recover pretty quickly after we get out of this.
I share your faith in humanity, but I think there's going to be the need for a bit more work. For example, one of the things that I would be insisting on and would be campaigning for until it happens or until I die, whichever comes first, would be an official apology from the police, a recognition that they allowed themselves to become politicized. I don't think, as much as, yes, I agree, we need to hold people like Daniel Andrews accountable, Brett Sutton accountable. There's been a huge amount of wrongdoing and accountability must be brought. I agree that we're going to have to extend a lot of forgiveness to the rank and file, even if we may not feel like they deserve it. That's kind of the point of forgiveness, is that you forgive people even when they don't necessarily deserve it. But I think it would be dangerous to simply turn a blind eye to it and move on, simply for the fact that it sets a precedent then. If they never have to acknowledge that it was even wrong in the first place, then it's very easy for us to get back there the next time there's a cynical or a psychopathic premier and there's some kind of an emergency. It's very easy for us to get back to the same place we are now. What would you like to see? Feel free to disagree. And what would you like to see in terms of actually giving the opportunity for some real healing and moving on, knowing that lessons have been learned?
I think a public apology would be the least of what they could do. In saying that, I would want to say sorry back to them as well, because they imagine being a good person and having to do what they're doing and then go to sleep at night with their children who are also suffering from the lockdown. Like, it's probably mentally very traumatic for them. Maybe it's even more traumatic for them than it is for us on the receiving end of the arresting. I don't know. So I would say sorry back, but in saying that, an apology is absolutely necessary and reform is necessary from the top down. I mean, you know, I think there should be a proper independent a body that helps people. Like, IBAC is, we all know what IBAC is, okay? It doesn't really do anything. So there needs to be more structure to protect people who don't have a voice moving forward. So we can learn from this and we can put things in place. And I think that's important. And who leads, who the police commissioner is, that is so, like, they're just appointed. They're not even voted for. So what if the people voted for the police commissioner? Wouldn't that be great? Or the police force voted for them instead of them being appointed.
So the counter argument would be yes, but we do vote for the police minister, right? The police minister is an MP. Would be the counter argument to say, well, we've already kind of got that. To me, the issue is not so much the person in charge. The issue is the fact that they allowed themselves to be used politically. So the way it's supposed to work is the politicians write the laws, the police then enforce the laws. But the politicians are not supposed to have any operational influence. They're not supposed to be saying, oh, shut down that protest, let that protest go. But as I understand it, that's exactly what's been happening, is the police are now responding to operational instructions from the government of the day. And there's a line that needs to be redrawn somehow and redrawn in a way that it can't be easily, you know, blurred out again. I mean, I don't know.
It's right. I just want to tell you about an interaction I had with a police member. I had to go to the police for something unrelated, and someone came up to me and hugged me and whatever, and he was like, oh, are you famous? And I was like, well, no, I just came out of prison, you know, for 22 days. And he was like, what? And I explained it, and he was like, well, good on you, you know. He's like, because of the state of emergency, we don't have conscientious objection. We're stuck. This has never happened before. We don't know how to say no. He's like, keep going, please. And because he wants us to crack it so that he no longer has to enforce tyranny. So it's this strange thing where they're wanting someone to fix it, but they're not willing to fix it. And so I don't know who's at fault or who's not, but it's a terrible situation.
I agree it's a terrible situation, and it touches me personally. I have some people very dear to me that are actually police officers and work in other areas of government, and it's certainly putting a lot of strain on those relationships, no doubt about it. So I can't wait for us to be able to put this behind us. But I do very strongly feel that this can't just be a matter of, okay, it's over and we all just move on and don't talk about the war kind of approach. I don't think that that's going to allow us to actually reunite in the same way, that the old wounds will still be open.
I think you're right. Do you remember a news reporter got arrested back in like March or April, and they got a public, it was a mainstream media.
They got
a public apology for it. But you know, we've never had that. So look, I think a good person would want to be accountable and we wouldn't have to ask for it, you know, but that's just wishful thinking. But there needs to be amends. Like, you can't actually apologize. You can't make amends just by doing nothing. You have to. So if a police officer knows that they've done the wrong thing, they need to do something to counteract it. So hopefully they just do that, you know.
This is a good comment from Dorian. Cops are too afraid to lose their jobs to fight against the tyranny. We saw exactly this in a video that someone got as they had a chat with one of the port squad, the public order riot, whatever they're called, port squad. And this guy was saying, look, I've got a family at home too. Like, it sucks. And you know, sort of the subtext being that he felt that what he was doing was wrong, but he had to feed his family and he didn't have other skills and he didn't have confidence he could get another job. And on the one hand, you kind of go, oh, that's so true. I want to make 3 points. Number one, initially, you're kind of like, yeah, okay, at a human level, I understand that. My second point is, how devious is Daniel Andrews that he's created these confrontations on our streets where the people on both sides are actually there for the same reason? The protesters are showing up because they've got families to feed and they're suffering. The police are showing up and shutting down the protesters and shooting at them with rubber bullets because they've got families that they're afraid they won't be able to feed. Like, I think this is a measure of just how Machiavellian Daniel Andrews is and how effective he's been at dividing our state with people on opposing sides who are actually there for the same reasons. But my final point is this. We've never, ever since the end of the Second World War, we had a war about this, and then we had the Nuremberg trials, Nuremberg 1.0, because who knows, there may have to be a second one, where we determined as a culture, as a society, that I was just following orders was not a sufficient excuse. And I can't help but feel that I'm just doing what I'm told. I've got a family to feed, or the other version, which is, well, we can't just pick and choose what laws we obey. I can't help but feel that these are all variations on exactly that theme. I was just following orders. I think there's going to be, for a lot of police officers who I know are good people, and like I said, I have them in my family. I have them in my friendship group. They are good people. I think for them, there is going to be this experience of almost waking up out of a bad dream and looking back at who they were and what they did and having to come to terms with the fact that they were that guy, you know.
So what would you do? What would you do if you were that guy?
If I was a police officer, I would like to believe that I would have raised my voice and accepted being court-martialed and fired. I would like to believe that that would have been me. And I think I can make some argument that it would have been me, because I could have kept my mouth shut about the whole COVID thing. I could have backed down at any point in time over the last 18 months, and I haven't. I've gone to the point of being arrested in the belief that I might be held for a very long time. I've gone all the way to this point. So I hope that what that says about me is that if I had been a police officer, if that had been the career path that I had chosen, I hope that that means that what I would have done is actually spoken up for what was right, and not simply gone along with it because of my job or whatever else. Now, having said that, people like you and I are outliers. You know, and this has been a really weird thing for me to accept through all of this. It's interesting. I'm arriving at a place where I am more comfortable in my own skin than I've ever been before. I've always internally rebelled against the idea that I'm in any way different. It's a very uncomfortable thing for me to, you know, it feels very arrogant. It feels very, I don't like people who believe that about themselves. And so I don't want to believe that about myself. But I think that this circumstance is proving that I'm a certain personality type, and there are certain things, there are fights that I can't walk past. And I would like to believe that I would have taken that same approach had I been a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally agree. Now, what would you do? And I would never second guess that for a second. And if anyone does, they're silly. But what would you do? And I know it's hard to put yourself in this position because you wouldn't do this anyway, but what if you did go along with the corrupt orders because you want to feed your family? And let's say you were a bit younger and you haven't quite figured out your courage of conviction yet.
Yeah.
Then you wake up one day, let's say it's all, so how do you make amends for that? What do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. That's genuinely difficult. Okay. So I have done a bunch of things that I now wake up and have that epiphany and realize this wasn't right. This isn't right. And I can't go to work and keep doing this. I would probably do what a lot of police have been doing, to be fair, and that is start calling in sick, start using my mental health days and things like that they do have as police officers. They do have access to those. And I do know that there are a number of police that have been doing that. I would potentially look to get reassigned. Now, that's not an easy thing within the police force. You get assigned to a certain job usually for, I think it's about 2 years, I think normally, before you can really actually ask for a reassignment. But if that was possible for me, I would probably look to try and get reassigned. But if there was absolutely no way for me to stop doing what I believed was morally unconscionable, I would hope that I would reach the point, even if it took me a little bit longer, if I was a bit younger and I was still figuring it out, it might take me some months, it might even take me until this point in the whole thing to have really actually discovered my moral compass. I still hope, I can't think my way through to a different conclusion than that I would eventually realize that I just can't keep doing it. Mm-hmm. I cannot continue to be a part of it. Yeah. That's what I hope. You know, I don't know.
It's something I've learned, obviously, and what a lot of people might not know is that standing up for your convictions actually feels so good. And even though it's difficult.
It's actually addictive in its own way.
It is. It's selfish. It's actually almost selfish in a way because you actually get quite a lot of satisfaction, but you've got to be careful not to go too far and look for confrontations when they're not there, obviously. It takes a bit of effort to find your conviction, but once you do, you will never look back because you'll realize you've got more strength than you knew and new opportunities will come around for you that you never thought would. Mm-hmm. Everyone I know, every doctor, every nurse, every policeman I know that has spoken out have gotten new careers or new lives and they never look back. They never look back.
Yeah.
So I would encourage anyone out there that you will be happier. Your family will actually, even if they have no food on the table, they will respect you more.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that. It's easy to say, but I'm saying I think that's true.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second then. Does that mean then that we end up in a situation where all the good cops have left the police force and the only cops we have left are the ones that don't have a conscience?
Well, I don't even think you can think about that because it's how you sleep at night with yourself, right? So even if there's a roll-on effect, you have to do what's good in your conscience or else you'll never be happy. So
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, good. Let me just bring up Fight Back Australia's comment here. The police can't see that Dan is even betraying them. Absolutely. Daniel Andrews has completely destroyed the standing and reputation of Victoria Police, an organisation that, yes, has never been perfect. No organisation ever is, but an organisation that I think was worthy of respect up until all of this happened and so many among their numbers just went along with it. But, yes, it is going to take decades for Victoria Police to recover from this, and I suspect that it's actually going to take until my generation is dead before the memory of this is kind of lost and Victoria Police can actually recover.
Look, I'm more positive than you, but that's because, this is happening all around the world. Police are acting like this in Italy, in France, in Canada, you know. So when it is found out that the narrative is all whatever it is, when it's found out, there could be more healing than we imagine in a normal situation because surely people have some sympathy of the fact that with the mainstream media and everything else, the brainwashing is so powerful. That's why it's there. There's the best psychological warfare geniuses at the top of this. It's not on accident that this has happened. Yeah. So I don't blame people for potentially being brainwashed. I'm just lucky that I wasn't brought up with TV in my home and I was always taught to critically think. I'm just lucky, you know, not everyone's like that. So, look, I don't think it's going to take decades. I think it will take a few big moments where, imagine if the police started walking with the protesters or imagine if they kneeled down for us like they kneeled down for other events. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, 100%. But see, that would go a long way towards that apology, that acknowledgement of, you know what, we were wrong. And I think you're absolutely right. If that happens, if that acknowledgement happens, I think this can happen a lot more quickly than my more pessimistic prediction a moment ago. People hate it when you draw comparisons between anything modern and what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s. But I want to talk about what happened after the war, where the Allies had won and they were left with a situation where there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Germans that had been a part of the apparatus, a part of the machine, whether they were German soldiers, whether they were guards, whether they were, you know, local enforcers of some sort. And they were left with the problem of what do we do with these people? These people have actively supported one of the most evil regimes that had existed up to that point in time. Now, Hitler was since outdone by Stalin, who was since outdone by Mao Zedong. But up to that point in history, this was the most evil, the deadliest regime that had existed. And what do we do with all these people? And they realize, well, we can't send them all to the gallows. That's going to create its own massive issues. We can't lock them all up. We can't actually, like, there's a logistical problem here. And so they settled on a path of re-education and facing these people with what they had done and basically essentially using the same things, the same brainwashing techniques to actually get them to be unbrainwashed and actually see with clear eyes what they'd actually been a part of. And I don't know, I feel as though with Victoria Police, there's almost going to have to be a new sort of charter, a new code of conduct drafted that officers are going to have to either agree to or resign. And that code of conduct has to include that they will speak up if they believe that they are being given orders that are immoral, that they will no longer accept orders that appear to be politically motivated instead of impartial application of the law. To me, I think a few big moments like what you talk about, plus an apology, plus a code of conduct, you either agree to this or you resign. Mm-hmm. Those three things I think would go a very, very long way to healing the wounds and allowing us to move on.
I agree. And think about all the new police that would want to come in, you know, when things go, you know, I know a lot of young men who would love to go in there and be a protester, but in a job, you know, like as in be what they want to see, you know?
Yeah.
So there could be a whole new lot of, you know, at the moment they're obviously trying to recruit the same type of people, but I think there needs to be a rejig of the whole system.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, and we've got a real task ahead of us. Washing away the damage done by Daniel Andrews. You know, for as long as the division continues, then in a way we need to view division as his legacy. And our task is to wash away his legacy and rid his legacy from our land. And that to me, the best thing that we can do, the best way that we can work towards that is healing the division that he's actually caused. So what's next for you? You've got now an advocacy organization rather than a political party. What's your focus now? Is it the next federal election? Is it the state election? Do you have other things going on? Give us a bit of a preface of where Monica Schmidt and Reignite Democracy Australia are going now.
Well, the community groups, we're just trying to grow them as much as possible. So, like I said, we've got...
What sorts of things are they doing? What are these community groups?
Well, they're basically once a week on a... Once a week, we have a Zoom meeting with all the leaders. We call them activators of the groups, and we give them resources and ideas and things like that, but they run absolutely autonomously. So how we help them is we send emails out to the data because we can segregate our email list into electorates. So we can actually promote just one event in one area. So we help to bring them the members, and they just do what they want, basically. I mean, there's a tiny bit of risk involved in that, but also... The autonomy is given to such great creativity and things like that. So some groups have 180 members and they're all vetted as well. It's really incredible. So those groups will end up being really, really good campaigning tools for the elections if they want to be. They don't have to be. They don't have to support UAP. They don't have to support anyone. They can even hate politics. So that's fine. So we're trying. So basically anyone can be an act. If there's no group in your area, you can put your hand up to be an activator. And we'll assist you along the way. We have 1.5 staff basically resourcing people, and we send out free flyers, business cards, and campaigns, all that sort of stuff. So we support them a lot. So it's that. But basically, the federal election, you know, it could come up really quickly, Topher.
March next year. It could be as early as March.
It could be earlier.
That's true. It's expected that the earliest it could be is March, but actually, it could be earlier. You're quite right.
Look, it could be really earlier. So we're just basically getting ready for that. So I've been asked to find the best candidates possible and I'm going to help to do that with UAP. But like I said, I can support whoever I want. So if other parties want my help, I'll definitely talk to them. And that's pretty – and then the legal cases. I mean, I've got my own legal cases to fight, of course, the 10th of November. Also the false imprisonment. October 31st, I was put in the back of a divvy van for 45 minutes. And with no charge, so that would be false imprisonment. So I'm fighting that as well. So legal and campaigning is kind of where I'm at, and content creation. So networking and just meeting as many people as I can internationally as well. The, like you said, you made a funny joke that I wanted to comment on ages ago. you thanked the police for what they did because it was perfect timing for your documentary. Mm. Well, I had a lot of fun in prison just thinking about this. I was like, you tried to silence me and you did the exact opposite. Well done. Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah, congratulations. You just owned yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
I do want to talk about the documentary for a moment. And Monica, you've agreed to come on and be a part of that. And I'm very, very grateful to you.
Yeah.
So the documentary is called Battleground Melbourne. Let me just share a screen here. It'll take me a second.
That's a big name.
Battleground Melbourne, and it's not intended to be a divisive documentary. This is a documentary that is literally designed to lay the groundwork for healing. Believe it or not, as confrontational as the poster may be, this is an early poster using the resources that we had at the time. This will be revised prior to the launch of the actual documentary.
Looks, but there's great three.
The graphic artist who did this is amazing, and I love her work, but she was limited in what she had to work with in terms of, you know, high enough resolution images and everything else. So there are three main themes. Number one, as you can see on the poster, Daniel Andrews, the concentration of power, the way that he has taken a liberal democratic state, liberal in the traditional sense of a free democratic state, and has turned it into a police state. There is no other word for it. Where the police are acting on behalf of the government of the day. The government is now expelling elected members of parliament from being able to participate in the parliamentary process. There is no other word for it. So, excuse me, a very, very strong theme of him and how he did what he did, because it wasn't supposed to be able to happen here. And we need to know, we need to go back and have a look. What happened? Where did we go wrong? How did we allow this to happen? And the rest of the world needs to know so that they can make sure they don't make the same mistakes. The second main theme is going to be the media and the absolute irresponsible reporting that has gone on, and the way that independent media have actually held them to account. So Rukshan is another one who's agreed to come on and be a part of the documentary, and I'm tremendously looking forward to interviewing him for this as well. We've got access to all of his footage as well. And so the media is the second main theme. The third main theme is the pushback. And people like myself, people like Monica, people and so many other good people who have tried to raise the alarm and tried to say, hey, this actually isn't okay. And then, of course, that then turned into protests, and that then turned into the police response and the violence. And that's gone all over the world. So obviously we need to talk about that. That's not a major thing. I'm not just trying to paint the picture of some city that's just in continuous violent crisis. I'm not trying to be unfair to anybody. And we will be including police officers in the interviews as well, and trying to put some understanding, I guess, not trying to excuse them, but trying to put some understanding into this of their point of view. But the main focus is actually to lay the groundwork for a way forward, a way for this state and this city to be able to move forward, to be able to heal some of the divisions that have been created by that man on your screen. Once we get rid of him, of course, and we hold him and a couple of other key people accountable, we've got to find a way to live together. And this documentary is designed to help make that happen. And we did meet the minimum. I had a minimum budget required of $65,000. We met that thanks to my arrest. That was wonderful. And we are continuing to try and fundraise, because that $65,000 was very much minimum. The commercial value of a project like this is about $210,000, just to give you a measure to work against. And we need marketing budget. I need to be able to give my editors and my graphics artists and everything as many hours as possible, and that's budget. So if you would like to support it, and let me say this, don't support this unless you're okay and your family is okay and the people immediately around you are okay, all right? Look after yourself and look after those people first. But if you're in a position, I would be very grateful for any support. I'm just going to stick the link. It's on a website called givesendgo.com/battleground Melbourne. That should show up as a comment in just a moment on all the different places where we're streaming. So I didn't want to use Patreon. I didn't want to use anything that was based in Australia because that could potentially be targeted for political reasons. So I've gone with a fairly small American fundraising site, and I cleared the project with them first, and they've assured me they're not going to let anybody touch it. They've got no issue with the project at all. It's crazy, Monica, that we even have to do these things. We even have to think about the possibility that we might get deplatformed or taken off. Like, it's just, Jackie, get in touch with me. Send a message to the Topher Field Facebook page, please. These are the sorts of things that I'm definitely looking for. It's crazy, isn't it?
I actually am kind of, the thing I'm angry about the most, and I use that word lightly, I'm not an angry person, but
Yeah.
I'm angry that I have been forced to act and think like someone who would be considered a criminal. So I have to think about, I'm from the country. We never locked doors. We never locked car doors. We never locked doors. We didn't lock anything. And now I'm paranoid about who's listening, who's following me, if the police are going to come here. And I just, I'm feeling and thinking like someone that I'm not. And I just hope that there's recovery for that. And I think that what you're talking about with the apology and stuff, I hope that there's some, and you were just talking about the fact that we had to think about the censorship and all this sort of stuff. It's not in our character to think like that. And it's weird.
Yeah, it is crazy. I want to grab a comment here from Jessica J6, one of my favorite trolls, by the way, because she never crosses the line into abuse. So I can let her just keep on commenting and feeding the algorithm and getting, every time someone comments, Facebook goes, oh, people love this, and they push it out to more people. So thank you, Jessica. I appreciate your support. She says, a non-biased film, ask Dan's government for film budget. This is not an unbiased film. I want to be really clear about that. This is me answering the misinformation and the lies from the government, from the mainstream media, and from the police. This is the byline, the subheading is the fall of the world's most livable city through the eyes of the people that risked everything to save it. This is our answer. This is our reply to all of the misinformation that's gone out there. So I appreciate your thought, but I don't think that Dan is going to be helping to fund this this film at all, Jessica.
He'll be helping to fund the squash of it, if anything.
In a way, he's already helped to fund it, actually, through the arrest of me. So thank you, Dan.
Absolutely. It's like every time they think that they're trying to stop you, they actually do the opposite. It's interesting they haven't learnt that lesson yet. that's funny.
So look, I'm very mindful that you did tell me you wanted to wrap up at about 9:30, and we're heading towards that mark now. So I'm incredibly grateful for your time. Telling your story. I hope that we've squashed a couple of myths and some of the misinformation that floats around. And I hope that people have gotten a lot out of tonight. I certainly have. I've thoroughly enjoyed catching up. I'm very grateful that you would go along with my crazy idea for us to have our catch up in public, where everyone would kind of see it and we could catch up with what's been going on.
Yeah. And can I say, I love the documentary idea. I love the title. I love everything about it. I think it's really good. A lot of people, and I've heard a lot of people talk about making a documentary and this and that and the other, but to actually go through with it is like a whole different step. And I obviously understand the work that's involved. So I'm really, really grateful that you're doing this because it needs to go down in history.
You need to tell the story. There was a question there about the name. It's called Battleground Melbourne. And there was a question about the release date. The target release date is the 20th of December. I want it to be out before Christmas so that over Christmas and New Year, people are talking about what's happened. Yes. No, this coming Christmas. So literally I need this to be out in about 8 weeks.
Whoa. That's crazy. That's actually a full-time job. I want to give myself a little opportunity here because I never respond to trolls and I never give them any airtime. And this is something that's like kept my morale up because I think they just want attention. And so I just don't give it to them. But I want to ask you a question. What do you think is the most, the thing that people say the most negative or questionable about me? And in this forum, I can actually address it.
Good. I would imagine that people are most often criticizing you because you're viewed as this person who raised all this money, blah, blah, blah. It would be to do with the fundraiser,
I would imagine.
Okay. All right. Well, I didn't know you until relatively recently, so you're going to have to answer the question, I'm afraid.
No, but I mean, the fundraising was only when I was in prison. Before that, I never did fundraising for myself.
Sure.
So RDA is funded by donations.
I don't know.
I guess that's a fair thing for people to think. I'll be completely honest about this. I have paid myself $500 a week since about October last year. So my staff actually make more money than me. Yep. So that's all documented and everyone's paid by PAYG. And I justify it? I had a really hard time asking for donations at the beginning. The only reason I became comfortable with it was when I was offering services that I thought were worth contribution if someone could afford it, like you just said before.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
providing, so for example, the website costs a lot of money to do. We've got a new app coming. You know, these things cost money, right? We have a 1-800 number and it's really busy. People just call to chat, okay? And we're not a helpline. So we have to use that time. So the money is, unfortunately, I couldn't make it a non-for-profit because of the political work that we do. But if I had made it a non-for-profit at the beginning, then it would have been better, but I wasn't able to. So now moving, I can't. So that's kind of sucks, but all the money goes back into the business. So,
yeah. Well, look, let me echo that. So I've been a political commentator for 12 years. Until about 3 months ago, the only fundraising I ever did was for specific projects. So there was a deliverable, video projects. There was a deliverable that I was accountable to deliver to a standard that my donors were happy with. And to my knowledge, I've literally never had a donor complain. No one has ever complained when they put money into one of my projects and then seen the project and gone, hang on, that isn't what I thought I was putting my money into, or that didn't look like it cost you as much as what I paid or whatever, right? But I realized about 6 months ago, and then I started working towards it, and 3 months ago, all the changes started. There's new branding and there's all sorts of stuff going on. You're going to see a heap more changes in the next 2 weeks as well. I realized that by me not asking for ongoing financial support, having a Patreon, I hate Patreon, so I'd never use them. I use a different company called Subscribestar. Because I never did that, and I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought I was like, okay, this means that I'm not asking people for money and I'm independent and I'm this and I'm that. I realize now that I wasn't able to grow my platform the way that I would have if I just got over myself a little bit. I realize now it's almost this weird arrogance. That's like, no, I'm not. I want to be seen a certain way, so I'm not going to ask people for money. There was sort of an elitism in that, at least for me. Like, I'm just talking about my own personality. And then I realized if I'd actually started doing that, let's say 5 years ago, how much bigger would my platform have been when COVID came along, and how much more of an impact could I have had, and how much more of a difference could I have made if I'd only just got over myself a few years earlier. So I now have four people working for me, and this is what's driving the changes that you're seeing. There's a new line of T-shirts that'll be coming out, launching hopefully later this week. I saw someone ask that question earlier, when are the T-shirts coming out? I should be able to share the designs with you later this week. I actually, this was a supporter who did this for free. All of these slow chats are being turned into podcasts. So he's actually doing that for free, and I don't count him in the four people that are working for me. I've got an admin person now. You're going to start seeing these slow chats being cut up into short little digestible segments and being re-uploaded and just reusing some of this amazing content. I have amazing conversations with people, and then once it's finished, that's it. Someone's got to sit down and watch for an hour and a half to see it, right? And so we're going to start making much better use out of that. But like you said before, you were working 14-hour days and you couldn't keep up. It's the same for me. So I've had to get over myself, and I started a Subscribestar. There's about 72 people that support me so far, and that doesn't even pay for one of the four people that work for me at the moment. So we're running at a loss at the moment, but that's okay. We can sustain that for a little while and hope that it grows and hope that it continues. And ultimately, what people see this, and they assume that you're just one person. They look at Monica and then say, oh, yeah, RDA is Monica. Well, no, it's not, actually. There's an enormous amount of hours. You get phone calls on your 1-800 number. I get messages and I get emails. And it's not physically possible for me to respond to them all. But when I see people that are really struggling, I make the time to write them a reply and to try and help them keep going or find some silver lining or whatever. I'm glad that you actually started accepting donations much sooner. I now look at it as a mistake that I didn't do it for 11 years.
It's a really uncomfortable thing, and I understand that. I think it's all about the intention. So if you know deep down that you're going to respect the money that people entrust in you, and that doesn't mean just spending it on yourself, but it's also being wise with how you're spending it, even with staff and things like that as well. So if your intention is good, 95% of people will see that. And the only people that complain are the people that aren't even donating.
Correct.
If there's ever any problems, I'm the first person to give the money back or send a replacement T-shirt or anything like that. And you know what? If people didn't donate, then I would then know that whatever I was doing was not needed in society.
Correct. But
I need to pay for myself to do things. So it's like, okay, people, do you want me to continue this, or do you want me to get a job and only be able to do 3 hours a day? Yeah. No, the people want you to do it full time. Okay. Yeah. So that's the answer to my, if I never was able to pay for things, then I would have gotten the answer and I would have just gone back to being a day job person, you know?
Yeah. As a tried and true capitalist, I wholeheartedly agree. And if there are people who see enough value in what you do and what I do to put their money where our mouths are, then who are we to second guess them and tell them that they're wrong? It's, you know, we just got to say, okay, then that's what I'm going to do.
And I think merchandise is really great because it's a way to make a little bit of money. It's not much. It's actually a lot of hassle, but they get something for it. So it's kind of like, even if they don't like it, they'll buy it because they want to support you, but they feel better because they're getting something. And we feel better because we're giving them something. So merchandise is a fantastic way of kind of getting through those buffers.
Yeah. Look, the thing I'll close with, Monica, do you want to tell people how they can find you? And then I will encourage people to get on my email list as well. And then we'll finish up for the night.
Sure. So reignitedemocracyaustralia.com.au. Everything's there. Go through the tabs at the top and have a look. If you want to join a community group, under community groups there, you'll see a list of all the groups. You can join one. If there isn't one, you can make one. And yeah, that's pretty, we do, just so you know, I don't know if I've told you this, but you know, the website's getting 250,000 views a week at the moment. So people are really enjoying the content. We send out emails every single day with the updated news and things like that. So, it's going really well. And so come on over.
Yeah, fantastic. And in my case, someone asked before about me getting deplatformed. It is a risk. I'm not one of those people that goes into the really dangerous territory, but it's always a risk. So the best thing to do would be to head over to topherfield.net. That is my blog. It's a little bit out of date at the moment, but my admin person is actually, their first job is to fix all of that, get it up to date, and then there'll be continuous content coming out on the blog.
Why aren't you on Telegram, Topher?
Look, I'm probably going to have to get onto Telegram sometime soon. It's because I already have four platforms. I'm on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and I don't even touch the Twitter. But this is the thing. But again, this is what we're talking about. I don't have the hours in my day to stay across that many platforms. It's only by having other people and paying other people that I can actually stay across that amount of platforms.
So if people want to see you grow, then they need to show you by supporting you, and there's nothing wrong with that.
It took me 11 years to get over myself and get to that point. So go to topherfield.net and you'll find, if you're on a phone, scroll a little bit and you'll see the opportunity to put your email address in there. If you're on a desktop, it'll be on the right-hand side. That way I can keep in touch with you no matter what happens to my socials, no matter what they try and do to me, I'll be able to keep in touch with you there. Well, Monica, thank you so much. This has been brilliant. I've thoroughly enjoyed this chat. I'm so glad that we got to catch up and that we also just got to put out in public things that I think people really need to know. And that way, there were lots of trolls on here, but there's a lot of other people that have listened to what you've said and go, okay, that makes sense. And now when other people, you know, want to get in their ear and talk to them, they'll be able to set them straight. So I think it's
been productive. Can I just make one final point?
Yeah, sure.
So I came up with this quote in prison, which was that during psychological warfare, collective courage of conviction is going to be our strongest weapon. So I think that because they're fighting psychologically, we need to fight back psychologically, and that means that in ourselves and collectively, we need to envision getting our freedoms back and winning because everything they're doing is they're trying to beat our soul, our spirit, take our people away from us. Everything that supports our mental health, they're taking away from us. So I would just say that even in your tiniest world, your lifestyle, whatever situation you're in, just find that courage that's already in you, learn how to use it, start voicing yourself, and you'll love yourself more for it. And then we will actually win for it. And we need you. We need every single person out there to find a bit more conviction. And then we're going to be okay. That's it.
100%. The only thing I will add is build a community around you at the same time. Yeah. Do that, and then also encourage others, build others up, build a community. Building a community around yourself is never a bad thing, no matter what happens in the future. It's time and energy well spent. So let's call it a night. Monica, thank you so much tonight. It's been a lot of fun. And I will see everyone on Thursday night. I have a very special two guests. The first time I've ever had two guests coming up on Thursday night. I'll tell you all about that on the Topherfield Facebook page in the coming days. Have a great night.
Thanks, Topher. We'll be in touch. Thanks. See ya.